Welcome to Bite Size Dental Marketing, a podcast where we talk to the most influential and brightest minds in the dental industry. Our mission here is very simple. We're out to create a community for dentists, hygienists, and dental enthusiasts where you can have access to the minds in dentistry that are solving the problems that you are having in your practice today. Now, whether that's dental marketing or patient reactivation, treatment acceptance, buying or selling a practice, or even just where the future of dentistry is going with all the technological advancements we're seeing and the pace at which the industry is moving, we want to create a place where you have understanding and have a roadmap on the small steps that you can take to make a practice better today so that you can feel it in your production and the joy of the work you do tomorrow. Enjoy.
Welcome to Bite Size Dental Marketing. Today, we have Justin Strong. Justin's the founder and CEO at Room 118. Been in the industry a long time, and I love a good origin story. Justin, let's have it. How'd you end up starting a company, and what in the world got you into dental marketing?
The short version is it's an homage to my grandfather. So my grandfather's named Roy. He was born in 1911. I'm in Utah. He was born here in Utah. And he was born into poverty. When he was seven years old, his father, who was a miner, died in the mines, and he became the man of the house at 6 years old. Kind of went through the depression and just had a really, really impoverished life as a child. And by the time he died, he'd built this sort of small empire here in Utah. Nothing grand, but he built two hotels, several apartment houses, and a bunch of other things. All self-taught. He was not formally trained as an engineer or anything like that, but he did a bunch of engineering projects. And the centerpiece was a hotel called the Best Western Room in Provo, Utah. It doesn't exist anymore. They tore it down to do some other development. But as a kid, myself and my cousins worked there. That was sort of, you know, kind of a rite of passage for a lot of the cousins, was to come in and work at this hotel, mowing lawns, doing maintenance stuff and everything else. And in the hotel, there was a converted room that was room 118. It was formerly a guest room, but we turned it in, or my grandfather had turned it into a workshop. And basically, at the hotel, if something was broken or if we needed to fix something, we all went to room 118, and that's where we fixed the problems. So room 118 is literally an homage to that room at that hotel that my grandfather built.
That is a great story. When you think about branding and its implications in marketing, and as you've gone through, you know, your own company, what are the high points and where do you see practices lose their way a bit?
So if you're a practice owner trying to understand what quote unquote good marketing is a, you know, kind of a first principle challenge, because if you don't know the answer to that, you're kind of at the mercy of others that know more than you, and hopefully their intentions are good. And I think mostly they are, but you don't necessarily know how to act on that information. So 3 years ago, we decided to come up with what we wanted to be the single authority on dental marketing when it came to data. So in 2023, we launched the first version of what we called then the Dental Digital Marketing Index. We've shortened that to just the Dental Marketing Index today. And at that time, we looked at 1,000 dental practices that were statistically representative of the 50 large major metro markets in the U.S. And we looked at anything we could observe. So we looked at, you know, we went to their websites, we cataloged what was the content, the structure, the organization, the type of, you know, did they have custom illustrations? Did they have, you know, stock photography? Did they have videos? All of that stuff. We ran it through a bunch of tools to determine, you know, how good is the website in terms of its performance? Is it code heavy? We looked at their social, you know, how big is their profile? How many followers do they have? How often do they post? We looked at their SEO performance. We looked at paid. We looked at their referrals, their reputation, all of that. And we came up with, at the time, we were pretty proud of it. Nobody cared but us. But we had this sample of about 4.4 million data points that represented those 1,000 practices. So that gave us a chance to kind of crack open that black box and just say, objectively, for some practices or for most practices, this is what marketing means. It's about 350 web visits a month from search. It's a domain authority of 7 to 8. It's probably somewhere between 150 and 200 followers, things like that. And today, the most recent version, we've gotten a bit more sophisticated in the size of the sample and the way that we're sampling. And we're marrying that with something that we're calling the Super Practice Blueprint. And all that is a fancy way of saying we've built some models that can look at all of that data at scale and then look at an individual practice and just say, okay, you have a practice in Des Moines, Iowa. Des Moines, Iowa has this population. It has these demographics. It has these growth characteristics, so on and so forth. That maps to a certain demand model in terms of you're going to have lots of ortho, or you're going to have lots of implants, or you're going to have a lot of GP, or whatever it is. And we can help you understand where your practice sits today objectively. We can score you on all these things and say your practice is doing great, or your practice needs some help, or you're like right in the middle. And then objectively say, if you want to increase your performance by 5%, let's say you want to add another patient a month on average, or you want to add 50 patients a month on average, we can help you understand, is that possible in your local market? And then objectively, based on the data, what would you have to do for that to be true? So that's sort of a quick high level of the index itself. And we thought that that was a need in the industry because it doesn't really exist, at least not in an accessible way for practice owners and DSOs.
I have two questions. Answer them in any way you want. Number one, how did you approach the correlation and causation problem that begins with that much data? So, you know, you need successful practices need 200 to 300 visits from paid media. I think you said, is the 200 to 300 visits drive the success of the practice, or was a successful practice the sort of capturing those anyway, right?
Yeah.
And the second question is, how are you tying it to like a P&L performance, or are you morally looking at marketing analytics, if you will?
I'll start with the second because it's both easier and more difficult to explain, so I'll try to get it out of the way. We've pulled data from the ADA, from some of the individual specialty organizations, and then from dental economics and a few others to build pricing models across the country. So we have a state-by-state pricing model that basically says, on average, there are these number of procedures for example, diagnostic and preventative care. There's going to be this many in the state of Maryland, on average. There's going to be this many that are restorative, this many that are prosto, and so on and so forth. And then we can look at the survey data that says, well, in that state, they tend to price high, low, or in the middle. And then we also look at the price elasticity in that state to say the 50th percentile versus the 90th percentile pricing has a big range or a little range. All of that goes into a model so we can say, well, the average cost of a procedure of a certain type in the state is going to be X number of dollars. And then the demographics are going to have an impact on that. Is it an affluent market? Is it an affordability-focused market? Is there lots of public insurance? Is there a lot of private insurance memberships? All of that stuff. So we can look at that and give us a baseline to say, well, this is what we should be getting transactionally from a win. We can look at information on if it's a GP. We can look at the average life cycle of that patient and that win to say, okay, they're going to make this much on the procedure. They're going to have a 65% adoption rate for them to enter their active patient pool. And then they'll continue to make money for some number of time. If it's a specialist, probably going to be more incidental in terms of that. But that gives us our baseline to say, well, this is what the result was. So we can use that in your baseline ROI calculation. When it comes to modeling the top of the funnel, I think you're spot on. It's one of the biggest challenges is, okay, let's say in a given market, there is 10 searches, just to keep the math simple. Let's say there's going to be 10 searches on the term dentist near me. And let's say, and this is something that we see pretty consistently in this super practice model, one practice is going to swallow up 6 of those 10 searches on average. Another practice is going to swallow up 2. Another practice is going to swallow up 1, and the remaining small portion of that is going to be parsed out among the next 6 practices and so on and so forth. Well, how do you know that those 6 searches that went to that super practice, how do you know that they did anything with it, right? How do you actually understand that? That's your question on correlation. We have to have an inference model because we can't crack inside each practice and say, show us exactly what happened. And in fact, even if we had access to it, they probably couldn't tell us exactly what happened because they can have trouble doing attribution. Our model basically does high-level correlation on a top-of-funnel activity. We have an assumption on conversions that basically says, okay, once this engagement has occurred, if I clicked on an ad, if I clicked on a search result, If I clicked on a paid placement on social, whatever the source of engagement is, we then profile those websites and say, okay, here's what we do know about a website that has this kind of content that performs in this way. The conversion rates should be in this range. And so we do jump and make an assumption on this amount of engagement results in this amount of conversion, which should then introduce the number of unqualified leads that hit the practice.
When you look at the 6 points from the index, which ones do you find that dentists tend to do well in, and which ones are underrepresented?
So, really good question. In its current instance, the way we sort of go about defining marketing, we say there's a top of funnel, that's the first pillar. There's the middle of funnel, that's the second pillar. And then there's basically a sales portion, a sales component. Practice by practice, we rarely see anybody do well, like on everything, right? There's usually what we'll see is we'll see a practice that maybe is really good at social. And so they have worked hard to build up a large following base on Facebook, Instagram, whatever their platforms are that they're using. They're posting regularly, and the engagement from those posts is consistent and well above average. That's one example of something we see all the time, but we rarely see that person also killing it on like SEO, right? They're not driving necessarily a proportional amount of performance when it comes to something outside of that. But very occasionally, and this is usually like a group practice where you can tell they've thrown a lot of resources at it, we will see some folks that do well across the board on multiple things.
When I think through the website, the SEO, the Google reviews, social engagement, paid ads, And then, you know, the last one is the life. Which ones do you see they tend to over-index or spend too much time on? Maybe because it's sexy. You mentioned social right out of the gate, right? And which ones do they, you know, it may not be interesting, or they tend to under-index the importance of it, right?
I don't think this is really to the fault of anybody. I think the absence of good information makes it difficult to make these decisions. But we see lots of money spent on websites that we don't think does anything. Case in point, there's a practice in New Jersey that has, a horrendous looking website. It is ugly. It's unpleasant to experience this website. And it drives something like 16,000 clicks a month on organic search, because they have found the way to hack whatever in their local search market with Google. They have found the right combination of, this is the content, this is the way it's laid out, the engagement on the content is good, their authority is really, really high. All of the stuff behind the scenes is fantastic. But when you go to that website, you're like, this is terrible. Then you go to a website that, and there's one, when we profiled this example in particular, we looked at the few that were around it. Beautiful, beautiful, what, full bleed video, custom everything, rollover effects and just this lush marketing experience on the website. And it was terrible in terms of its SEO performance. And so I think one of the things we see objectively is you probably should spend at least initially, the biggest portion of your marketing budget, I would argue, on your website for a whole host of reasons. But people think that means it looks beautiful and it looks in a certain way and all of that, which matters to a point, but not to the exclusion of there's certain, you know, it's like having a balanced diet. There's a bunch of stuff they need to have done that maybe they don't think about.
You mentioned, you know, defining dental marketing in the absence of information makes it hard. I find that, you know, as business owners, we hear some anecdotal story about how someone had success. And I love the one about mailers. Like my buddy did mailers 10 years ago and generated 287 new patients I'm going to do mailers. I'm like, Mel, that was 10 years ago. He was in El Paso, Texas. You're not like, how are you having conversations around this multi-channel attribution world, where we really like bite-sized nuggets of just give me the thing that works. Like, right. What should I do? How are you having those conversations?
I think that's where the data is helpful, because it's one of the challenges, and this is part of why we wanted to produce this index to begin with. One of the challenges, you know, if I'm in that conversation and I walk in cold and somebody says, well, I heard somebody do this, Justin, why shouldn't I do it? I had a client do this 3 weeks ago. And I just said, I don't doubt that person had that success. But that does not necessarily mean you will have that success on its own. When we look at the data at scale, I'm going to pull out mailers because there's not great, you know, representative examples.
I love the story because when you're dealing with a mailing company, the only answer is more mailers.
Right. Right. It's saturation, of course.
It's saturation.
Why not?
It didn't work the first time. They're like, no, you need to spend more money.
Which, by the way, always the best answer. Didn't work. Well, we need to spend more money. That's why it didn't
work. That's right.
I think one of the things, going back to this notion of a super practice thing, if we plot all those 1,000 practices on any dimension, and I'm gonna go back to SEO as an example because it's one that most people hear a lot and I think has efficacy. If we look at all 1,000 practices, we plot them on a chart, their monthly search traffic, and it gets different when you talk about unbranded versus branded and some of the other things. But if we just kind of keep it simple, we'll see a curve not unexpectedly. On the left-hand side at the 1 percentile cohort is the lowest performance. And if we just then rank them in terms of performance, we see a nice curve develop. But the nature of that curve is sort of like the Pareto principle a little bit on steroids. And that curve is really flat until you get to about 60 to 70%, depending on the metric. And then after 70%, it starts to climb. And by 80%, it's getting near vertical. And at 90%, it just goes off the chart. And so what's happening is you talk about that one person that had that great experience on mailers. They're that person on the end of the chart that's going off into space. What we then have to ask ourselves is, well, in your market, is that even possible? And is it statistically replicatable? Can we see the constituent components that went into a program that tend to result in that kind of performance? In some cases, we had very loose correlations, and so we don't make those recommendations. But in the case of something like SEO, it's really clear. Like, there's super high correlation between what we call cumulative backlink authority, just the sum total authority score of all the backlinks, excluding toxicity and other things, the type of content they have, the relationship of total number of pages on the website to pages that rank on SEO. We look at those metrics and we can see a very strong correlation to the amount of traffic they're going to drive. But to your point about mailers as well, what about the local market? Is there enough search even occurring that if you capture 60 or 70%, is it going to drive whatever it was, the example, you have 280, you know, new patients or something like that? Our approach is to scientifically look at that local market and tell you, well, this is how much should be coming every month in your local market. This much should be coming from search. Dive into search. This is how much from organic. This is how much from paid search. This is how much from local search results going to maps and so on and so forth. Same thing for paid display. Same thing for social, so on and so forth. And unfortunately, I love the focus of the podcast where it's like, well, let's keep this bite-sized. It's really difficult. It's sort of like telling somebody, just do this one thing and you'll have perfect oral care. It's not quite that simple. Mm-hmm. There are nuances to doing it well. But I think reducing the complexity, your example of I had this one person do this one thing well, that is the right way to do it. Don't boil the ocean. That's the other thing. Don't try to do all marketing all at once in, you know, at the same time and have reasonable expectations. You know, do a few things well, work with your agency or whoever's working on your marketing and do those few things well, measure them, get the performance up high, and don't take on something else until you have one thing sorted out.
Would you say the base of that is the website? I mean, if you don't have a great website, can you have great social without a great website? If you have amazing reviews, is the website the nucleus of this effort?
Absolutely.
In your opinion?
Absolutely. I mean, it just empirically based on the data. I mean, there's of the entire data set that we have now, something like less than 1% don't have a website. There's some that just have social profiles. There's some that just have GMB profiles, things like that. Those are rare. But again, if we come back to this notion of, if you think about your local market, all of the people that could become your patients, let's, again, to keep the math simple, let's say there's 10 people that could become patients. Okay. Well, statistically for a GP, 3 of them are going to find you by search. One of them will find you by a generalized display ad. 3 to 4 are going to find you by referrals. And then, you know, 1 or 2 are going to find you by what I would call legacy, like your mailers or your bus reps or whatever people are doing. If you don't have a website, almost 80% of that, maybe even more than that, basically disappears. If you don't give them a destination to go to, and you don't more specifically give the things that are giving them that information, like Google, a destination to go through, you're in a lot of trouble. And it's not enough just to have the awareness piece. It's also converting them once they go to the website. So part of it is having a website that people can go to, a destination, and it needs to be built well. It needs to have landing pages and other things for you to do testing. It needs to have all of that. It needs to convert those people. And then the last thing is, and this is something that I think is probably not going to be top of mind for most practice owners, it is your greatest source of analytics. It is the nexus of anything else that you're doing. If you've structured things well, I would say most practices are doing themselves a disservice if they don't have a website that helps them understand what works and what doesn't work.
Can you dig into that a little bit for me? If like, how would I, if I'm a practice owner, how would I understand the analytics? I mean, you know, someone's throwing bounce rates and
right.
These terms at me, right? What is it that I'm looking for?
The real rough statistical rule of thumb we put out there for kind of what you want to see on a website or just in marketing in general is whatever the engagement rate is for the top of funnel. So when I say top of funnel, again, somebody that does a search, somebody that sees something on a social post, whatever, those dynamics have a lot of chaos about them. But once they hit the engagement level, once they hit the website, we kind of want to see a 3-3-3 ratio. We want to have, of the people that hit the website, we want to have about a 3% conversion rate across the board. And when I say conversion rate, I'm saying they have a phone call to your practice, they complete a form, or ideally you have a dynamic scheduler and they can schedule their own consult right there. Of those we generally consider to be unqualified leads. From a marketing standpoint, they've expressed interest, but you have not yet determined if they are actually a fit for your services or the type of patient you want. Probably they are, but maybe they're not. If you have a high specialty practice like you do in implants or something like that, you might be very particular about who you want to see. Once that happens, we want to see at least a 1-3 ratio of folks turning into what we consider qualified leads, meaning we sell them what they need and we want them as a patient. The last angle is when you talk about case presentation outside of things like, you know, your run rate preventative and diagnostic, but for your more high dollar things like implants or prostho or perio, we want to see a case acceptance rate of about 1 in 3 as well. So on the website, I would, and Google Analytics is a bit technical, I think, for most folks, but however you choose to do this, I would want to see of the folks that hit the website and have a conversion. Scheduler, and then identify where I have a blockage or where I have underperformance, and that's where I would put my focus.
You mentioned online scheduling, which every dentist I've ever met thinks their schedule is some unique flower that only they can replicate.
Right.
I mean, obviously, we love online scheduling. How do you see it progressing over the next few years? And I mean, you said hopefully they have online scheduling when you were talking earlier. How are you integrating it in, and where are we going with it today? Because today, I believe most practices, the online schedule is really request an appointment that then the practice has to call back and confirm, and that there's a level of overhead there that they dislike.
I think there's just a changing reality. This is and you can't stop it. So 29% of practices in our index have a scheduler of some kind, and I would define a scheduler as I can pick a time, not I request a time. So that number's up from a few years ago because I think it was about 17 or 18%. There is a trend where more practices are having online schedulers. But you're absolutely right. When I've talked to practice owners, I hear the same thing. This idea of, I want to control my schedule, which is I would want to do the same thing. The problem is your patient base, your prospective patient base isn't going to tolerate that. This gets into a much deeper conversation about some of the other trends data that we've looked at. But in 2023, one of the big takeaways of the report was something we called the near me wave. And so we looked at 35,000 keyword search terms and indexed them to, you know, this is this type of procedure, this type of procedure, this is talking affordability, this is talking convenience. The one that destroyed everything was proximity-based search, near me, right? So we looked at dentist as a search term since 2010, then we looked at dentist near me. In 2010, nobody was searching dentists near me. Smartphones had just started to really become a thing. And so you had the search term of dentist getting like 1.5 million hits a month across the entire country. And today it's like 2 million hits a month. Had this slow, gradual increase. When you look at dentist near me, has this increase, and then it's something like 3 million hits a month now. It overtook everything. It went from not being how we search to the only way we search, or the primary way that we search. That speaks to a focus on convenience. That speaks to, I am prioritizing convenience probably over quality of care, to be perfectly honest. A no scheduler's question. Part of that, right? The scheduler's convenience. And if you take that convenience away from them, they're just going to move on to the next thing. And the last thing I would say about that, if we go back and look at data from 25 years ago, for a GP, your average life cycle in time for most GPs was 15 or 16 years for a patient, right? You got a new patient, they stuck around for a while. Today, there's a lot of chaos in the numbers on this, but the number we see now is about 72 months. So that means this is happening more often, which means the opportunity to find a new dentist is happening more frequently than it used to, which means this preference towards convenience is actually going to magnify where patients go. So if you're a practice that got away with, I don't have a scheduler, even today you may be like, oh, it's fine, it's not a big deal, but you're shedding patients that you don't know. And the guy down the street from you that does have a scheduler is taking up more of them than you are yourself. It's just, it's really critical.
What are you seeing as the trends of why are we changing dentists? Is it, are we moving more? Are we just impatient? Are we cycling through different insurance plans more quickly? Do we just have the comparison game of someone's going to a better dentist? What's the story behind the rapid change?
We called this the Karen effect in the 2023 report.
All right.
Basically, the barriers to selecting a new dentist are falling down. It used to be kind of a pain, right? Like 25 years ago, like when I opened up the
paperwork
yellow pages,
The paperwork alone is enough to deter me. Yeah,
and so it's like, okay, I had a bad experience, but it's not worth it. I'm not going to do it, right? So it just didn't happen as much. Today, it's like, I didn't like the wallpaper in my dental practice, so I'm going to walk out and find a new practice. It's going to take me 30 seconds to get 25 options that are close by. GMB is Google my business is going to give me a proxy for trust by looking at the value of their scores and their reviews. It's just easier. And when I talk about the Karen effect, all of the technologies that have made things easier for us, I can buy something on Amazon, it shows up tomorrow, all of that stuff. It's just changed our behavior as consumers. We're more demanding. We're less tolerant of things we don't like. And those things have made it so that we can make that change. If for whatever reason, if I just want to make a change with my dentist, it's just easier than it's ever been.
I've always struggled to, as just a rank and file consumer, it is so difficult to gauge. And I'm interested in your opinion on this. I don't know that there is an industry where you have these typically introverted business owners, being dentists.
Right.
They get into it because it's the art and the blending of science and the crafting of your hands. And then you're a real business owner, right, first. And I 10 or 15 years ago, I believe that if you were a great clinician and an average business owner, you ran a good operation. I think today, if you're a great clinician and an average business owner, you're probably a good employee for a DSO at this point.
Yes.
What has happened? Is it just, we're just more complex? Is it the world's moving faster? The stories of, there's a dentist out there that has a bad website with no reviews and they're killing it, is getting rarer and rarer.
And quickly, that rarer and rarer is happening faster and faster. So many conversations around this. So I want my dentist to be a really good clinician, first and foremost. We all do. We all do, right? Like, I don't want that whoever you are, he or she, I don't want them to be focused on, I'm the best business manager on earth. No, I want them to give me the best care possible. So I look at that and I'm like, I'm really sympathetic to this issue. And it used to be, again, going back, you know, 25 years, and in some cases longer, some cases shorter, you hung a shingle out, you had services we all needed. Just focus on giving good care. And, you know, if you hang that shingle, we will come. We will get there. That's just not the world today. You brought up this notion of consumer behavior, and I think you are spot on. That behavior, that, like, if you look at search trends are blowing up, massive search volume. The population's not changing that fast. It's behavior that's changing, and it's changing radically. Today, I think the challenge that a practice owner faces is, well, how do I remain focused on being this really good clinician, but not ignore the fact that I'm also running a business, and I can't pretend that there isn't value to investing in that business? And I actually think, you know, right or wrong, I was on another podcast recently, and we were talking about this issue of, is it good or bad that DSOs are on the rise? You know, they continue to swallow up more and more of the local practices. And my thought is, I think it's a normal, healthy thing. And I think, like a lot of things, there'll be some balance that's introduced to the market at some point. But the DSOs are introducing scale and sophistication that your local practices can't necessarily compete with. I think the answer to that is, there needs to be more tools and resources that are, and I think this is the biggest term, accessible to a practice owner. There's really smart marketers out there, but if I don't understand them, or I don't like them, or something, you know, that's not going to help me. And I don't need somebody that's really smart at marketing. I just need somebody to solve this problem so I can go back to being a good clinician. So I think there is this tenuous relationship between DSOs and the local practices that are actually going to help both in the end, but yeah, it's not a fun place to be when you're having to try to feel like you have to pick between being a business manager and a really good dentist.
No, it's a tough place to be. And if you need no other data point on how effective DSOs are becoming in marketing, in that when you looked at DSOs 7 years ago, they were hiring, I'll say that their CMOs and their leadership in marketing were people from dental, which I think is great. That's fine. But now they're bringing in Procter & Gamble alums. They're bringing in these people from outside the market, because if you're in consumer packaged goods or you're in some other form of industry, you understand multi-channel attribution, and you're bringing a level of sophistication to marketing that, you know, just didn't exist in dentistry. It was, you know, for years it's been, hang a good website and, you know.
I would say did it not exist, but the economics weren't there to support it, right? There's a cost to doing that level of marketing. And you talk about, you know, somebody like Procter & Gamble, somebody that does, you know, massive consumer products. They are their own ecosystem in their own right, right? Like, you know, they have more data on one product line than the whole industry of dental has collectively, right? You know, and so DSOs, I think, do bring that level of resource focus, because the economics start to make sense. I do think there is something, I personally don't want to live in a world where it's all DSOs. I also don't want to live in a world where they don't exist, right? I do think that there is going to be some, it's a competitive aspect that is going to ultimately help everybody in the end.
Agreed.
But it's going to be a challenge to endure it over the next several years.
Well, I think you go back to it's not the strongest that survive, or the fastest that survive, it's the most adaptable to change. And the DSOs have raised the bar on the quality of care that you need to radiate. Now, I'm not saying you can't have quality of care, but you know, I want to get into video content as we talk about this, but that's one area that I find the dentists don't want to do. They no one enjoys being on video. No one, you know, but yet, telling me the technology you have, telling me you have a comb beam is great, but so do you. I can hit 7-iron from comb beam to comb beam to comb beam. And
right.
That differentiate you.
And what does that even mean to your prospective patients anyway, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You had $250,000 to burn. I don't know what it means. Yeah. We've talked about DSOs. We've talked about the changing market. We've talked about, you know, the the marketing index. Where do you see dental marketing evolving? How do you see it growing over the next 2 to 3 years with the consumer demand?
I think that in the same way that this has happened across other industries, where you have a very homogenous SMB slice like dental. One of the things I like about dental, one of the reasons the index is even possible, is we have 135,000 dental practices in the U.S., 115,000 of them are GPs. They have a lot of similarities in terms of their needs and so on and so forth. When we look at other, this is the same issue has been happening to broader healthcare for 25 years anyway, right? A lot of your local doctors' offices have been absorbed into much larger organizations. And that trend, I mean, with private equity, that goes into everything from car dealerships and plumbing companies to all kinds of things. So this trend that's happening in dental, I think is it's not a new thing. So we can kind of have some learnings from that. I do think the big changes that are going to come is just we have to have the ability to manage complexity. And to your point, that requires adaptability. There's a lot of folks that I would throw myself into this. I don't like change that I didn't instigate. I don't like it when the world changes and I didn't get my permission to do that. But that is just going to happen. It's going to happen faster and faster. And if you're adaptability is a muscle. You need to get comfortable. If you want to run a practice, you need to get comfortable with that. That's just a fact. You can't not having that focus on adaptability and staying current on what's happening is sort of like saying, I want to be a dentist, but I really don't like teeth. So I'm just not going to. No, you have to do. That's just something that's part of the deal. And I think you hit on it. A lot of folks that are really good clinicians that are okay at running a practice, they're probably going to continue to face this question of, do I sell my practice to a larger organization? I think, though, the blessing and the curse in all of this is there are, when you look at technologies over time, complexity comes up. And then the complexity comes down. You have these really state-of-the-art things that were built for very specific things and very, very, you know, high-end uses, and then they get consumerized. That's happening with dental tools and marketing technologies more broadly. The index itself is part of that. We're trying to be a part of that conversation about reducing complexity and giving tools to folks so they can make good decisions. I do think, though, I mean, that your question also leads into, like, well, what are the other trends in the next 5 to 10 years that really are going to hit practices? And, you know, and I don't know if you want to go there or not, but there's some big ones, I think, that everybody kind of knows about, but they do need some attention. Mobile, like, I got to ask you a question. How many of the folks that you talk to think that mobile is important to their marketing?
It would be hard for me to give a number. They hear it and repeat it. I don't believe they understand what mobile first means or mobile. I think they're repeating words, like saying I need to advertise on TikTok. I think it's a similar, right. They'll say the words because I think they're repeating something, but I don't know that they really understand the impact of mobile. Limited.
Based on your what you've seen and what you observe with your own experiences, how much traffic to a practice's website is mobile?
Oh gosh, near 100. 87. Yes. I'm gonna guess.
It's on the lowest end samples we've seen, it's in the mid-80s. And it's like 94-95% for most practices. And so you talked about like video earlier. And I had on Costas's podcast a couple of years ago on this, and he said something to the effect of, well, you know, I thought video was something that Google liked. And I'm like, it depends. Like, optimized video that's delivered crisply, quickly, and is part of an experience, yes, that increases engagement time. That's time on site. Google sees that. They're going to increase your authority score. But if I had this big, beautiful, you know, panoramic video that is now sliced into this tiny thing, and 95% of my traffic is going to get this really suboptimal experience. Actually, video is bad. And so when we talk about the future in industries outside of dental, we've been shouting mobile first for 15 years. And even those industries struggle to really adhere to that.
No question. And I think it begins with when a developer starts building a site, they're doing it on a 38-inch monitor.
Yep. Yep.
I
almost feel like those dev environments need to basically take away the ability to build on anything but mobile and then create tools to make that mobile experience extensible to a desktop. It's just, I don't understand why that's still an issue. So mobile isn't changing. And you talked about making video for TikTok. We're doing so much stuff on our phone that, you know, the old school approach was, I'm going to build a website that when somebody decides they want to have dental services, they need help. They're going to go to that website. I'm going to show them what I do. They're going to click on something and they're going to call us. They're going to schedule whatever. That's not what's happening. I'm on my phone. I see something on TikTok or I see something on Instagram. I then cruise on over to your website for 5 seconds, like what I see, but I'm not in a position to want to do something right then and there. So I'm going to go back to what I was doing. And then at a later date, I'm going to find you with a branded search or something like that. Mobile is so important. You just have to think about engaging with your world as if the only window was that mobile device. I think that's first and foremost. I would also throw out that there is a change in SEO. We're seeing this, and our models are being updated with this version of the DMI. Search is no longer just search. And I think you can speak to this probably better than I can. But if somebody does a search for dentist near me, what do you see?
Oh, I mean, Google has rolled out new map packs. There's sponsor. There's, frequently asked questions. There's also information, sort of suggestions. The organic result is getting pushed further down and down the page.
Exactly. Exactly. So like I still, our research still supports the notion that about 30-ish% it'll drop or increase based on population density and a few other things. But basically about 3 in 10 of your new patients probably found you on search, but the experience on search is not what it used to be. And so the idea that I need to take this approach of, you know, what I did 10 years ago, I have content that's engaging. I really focus on my authority score for that content. I really make sure that it's trusted and all of that. Nobody's scrolling down to it anymore. It's all going to the map. And so most of that 30% that's coming from search, if you drill into that, a huge piece of that is never leaving that map path experience, right? You're just seeing, these are all the dentists near me. I'm going to make a quick decision based on how close and the scores that I see. And maybe I won't make a final decision, but I'm going to exclude a whole bunch of stuff that maybe used to perform really well on mobile. So we look at that and we say, managing your GMB profile is now just as important as managing your website to search performance. And if you don't have a really good GMB profile, you're doing yourself a disservice. If you put money into your website, absolutely make sure your GMB profile looks good. You've got good reviews. You've got review solicitation. The last one is again, kind of obvious, but it's AI. And before I say anything, I want your thoughts on what do you think AI is going to do in the next 5 to 10 years to this whole experience?
My belief is when it comes to raw marketing, understanding your consumer is where we need the most help. So in the next 5 years, I will say that AI is probably going to make a good marketing message more effective in the channels I can reach and you know, the ability to generate content and script out a video or consume a podcast more quickly is where I would say it's going to be. I think it's going to accelerate people that have a good plan or a good understanding of their consumer will make better use of it. The people that don't will probably just replicate a poor message over and over. Probably how I would say in dental marketing. Yeah.
I think I agree with all of that. The thing about AI that I think is most interesting that will impact dental is AI is, and I think this was always the point of an LLM, of a large language model, AI is going to be specific to you. It's going to know you. It's going to know me. It's going to know anybody that it's interacting with. It's going to know your preferences, your fears. It's going to know what food you like. It's going to know, do you have sleep apnea? Like, it's going to know everything about you. And it's never going to require them for, if they have a question on, I want to find a new dentist, I'll never have to go to a website. I'll never have to look at Google reviews. I will trust that AI, right or wrong, I will trust that AI in almost everything that it's doing because it knows me so well, and I don't want the inconvenience of having. To me, that's the long game here that folks need to start to prepare for. In the same way that your marketing was meant to ultimately speak to consumers going through various channels, we need to start thinking about how that marketing builds authority and communicates to an AI platform.
Justin, from the story about Roy to hotels to correlation causation, the 80-20, man, we've covered a lot of ground here. Thank you so much for being on the show. I would love to have you back and dig deeper into some of these topics. But thank you so much for your time and for being out there trying to make the digital dental world a better place.
I appreciate you taking the time and hearing me talk about some of my passions. So thank you, Eric. I appreciate it. It's been great.
And that was your bite of dental marketing for the day. And the most important thing is don't listen to the episode and do nothing. We record these episodes so that you can take it and make a real difference in your dental practice. So take the advice we've given you, apply the action, do what you need to do, and make the difference in your business. And if you need some help, painfreedentalmarketing.com will listen to a couple more of our episodes so that you know what you need to do to put the best foot forward and make that difference in your practice.